everybody, and welcome to The Christian Contrarian. I'm author Gary Wayne, author of The Genesis 6 Conspiracy, and this is episode 6. And the title and the subject for the show today are, what did the giants look like and the various kinds of giants that may have been created? And when we look at the giants, we have two different versions of the giants in terms of before the flood and after the flood. Somehow they show up after the flood, and they're referred to in different terms. So when you take giant back to its Hebrew word in Genesis 6 and Numbers 13:33, where it refers to Anakim, which in Deuteronomy 2 are called Rephaim, these are the descendants of giants, and giants goes back to Nephilim, which are the same as Genesis 6. But all the other references in the Old Testament go back to Rapha or Rephaim for the word giant. And so there's a distinction. We don't know what that distinction is exactly, but because God intervenes in Genesis 6:3, and also with the flood, they are diminished in some sort of capacity with power, size, and what have you. But I do think they are more of a downscaled version of the original Nephilim. So we're going to talk about, what does it mean by giant? And does it just mean a 7-foot person compared to a 5-foot person? And I'm going to make the case today that no, that's not the case. These were hybrid offspring of angels with human females, and they received additional traits from the angels, the sons of God of Genesis 6. And they would have utilized these additional powers and capabilities to do what they did, which was to usurp the antediluvian world and the post-diluvian world by taking control of the kingships and imposing their polytheist Babylon, Babel religion over the people, and to set up a feudal system that I've talked about, where they and their relatives are the elite noble class, and the humans are the mundane servant class, only worthy of ritual sacrifice and enslavement and whatever else they would like to do with us. And so when we look at these Nephilim, and they're described as giants, when we use a diminished post-diluvian reference, which is our only reference that we have for size, and understanding that these will be smaller, then we understand that Goliath was 6 cubits and a span. And depending on whether or not you're using a common cubit of 18 inches or a royal cubit of 21 inches, that would make Goliath over 2,000 years after the original Nephilim were created, and in a diminished size, would have made him 9 feet 9 to 11 feet 3 inches, depending on how you want to apply the measurement there. And Og's bed was, he was 9 cubits, which would place his bed at somewhere between 14 to 16 feet, and Og at somewhere between 12 and 14 feet. And it was made of iron because a wooden bed would not support his weight. Which now goes to, how big were the original Nephilim? And how big were the ones that may have been created immediately after the flood? So to answer the first question is, most people think 20 to 40 feet tall. Now Amos talks about the Amorites being like the cedars of Lebanon, which grew 36 to 50 feet. That is a metaphor, you know, for describing the size, just as grasshoppers in comparison to the Nephilim that the Israelites felt, is again more of a metaphor. So we can't take that to the bank, but most experts feel that the original Nephilim before the flood were somewhere between 20 and 40 feet. So we think probably Og would be a little bit more reflective as being the last of the Rephaim after the flood, probably of the original Rephaim for after the second incursion, which I lean towards in terms of how giants show up after the flood, and have a document for people if they want that. Just get a hold of me through my website. And so I think we're looking at beings that might have been somewhere from 14, 15 feet to 18 feet after the flood, and getting smaller as some of those bloodlines start to get diluted. Now their width were thought to be 2-to-1, with their width to height ratio thought to be 2-to-1 versus 3-to-1 of the average human, which would make them about 50% wider. So these were hulking, massive beasts. And so not only were they huge, but they were muscular like a football lineman or a WWF wrestler, only much, much larger. And they also had sloped heads and elongated skulls. And these elongated skulls did not have sutures, and there's lots of these on display. And you can flatten the head and make it elongated through binding at childhood, but you can't increase the capacity and you can't get rid of the sutures. And these skulls are absolutely monstrous compared to human beings, which again fits the look that the Nephilim and the Raphaim had, which I'll get to a little bit later. We're also told in the accounts that their eyes glowed, and particularly out of the book of Enoch and out of other polytheist accounts, that their eyes shone, it would absolutely light up a room. So that's how they're known as the shining beings, which is an important understanding. Shining being one of those traits, again, that they get from the angels because they are shining opalescent beings. And so I think the size and the head and the shining aspect of them are part of these traits that we're talking about. And their neck was longer, like a serpentine neck. And of course, with the term Anak that I talked about, or Anakim, that goes back to long necked. And a lot of the names like Rapha, which can mean a tribe of giants or demon deceased spirits, these names were labeled to describe the Nephilim for the most part. And so we have these long necked, elongated skulls, shining eyes, monstrous beings, and we also are told that they have 6 toes in some cases and 6 fingers, as in the account of David's time with the 6-fingered and 6-toed giant. And what's interesting about that, in the time of Joshua, you have a king called Adoni-Bezek, who's captured, and he's known as the toe collector. And Adoni-Bezek would be a Rephaim king of that period, as was Og or Sihon were, and he seemed to collect toes from Nephilim, likely because of their size and the number of the toes, which was showing, I guess, sort of a legacy record of their winning streak and how many giants they had killed, because they weren't totally directly believing the same thing, but they were also trying to have their dynasties and their bloodlines as being the number one bloodline. And that continues today and will continue through to the end time, that internal sort of shuffling for position. We also have the great dexterity that these beings had. So they just weren't sideshow freaks. These were warriors, just as Goliath was the greatest warrior of his time. Nephilim, Rephaim, before, after the flood, were always known for their warrior aspects. And so if they weren't the kings of their kingdom, then they were part of the warrior class. And again, that's an important understanding to have, that the warrior part is a significant piece of that upper class and how they enforce the feudal system over human beings. And so where we're leading now with all these other descriptions is, I'm going to now lay out that the Nephilim and the Raphaim, originally before the bloodlines got diluted, had the face of a viper. And we get that imagery from around the world, where you have kings of all sorts and shapes around the world, but typically they have, for the most part and the majority, of a face of a viper in antiquity and before the flood. And even after the flood, they continue with this iconology, whether or not it's the pharaohs in Egypt with the cobra, whether or not it's the Sumerian kings that were referred to as serpents, whether or not it's pendragons that come down through history in the Celtic Scythian-based imagery, which all goes back to the same imagery, whether or not it's the Chinese dragon kings, and on and on and on. We have the serpent imagery again across the ocean with the Quiche Maya and the Aztecs. It's a commonality linking their legacy back to seraphim angels. And the seraphim angels are the watchers of Enoch and the watchers of Daniel 4. And we learn about seraphim angels in Isaiah 6 as the seraphim, which is the seraph, and I am is the male plural. And these were the fiery serpent angels. And just as they passed on all of these other extraordinary traits to this hybrid being of humans and angels, the original Nephilim, and probably even down to the time of Akhenaten and later, they still had this serpentine look. They had this elongated skull. Just look at an Akhenaten statue and you see these serpentine imageries, and you've got these eyes that are large and sort of slope back, and you've got this elongated skull. So he has that serpentine imagery. And we know also through other applications that the idea of a serpent and a fiery and a flying serpent is used throughout the Bible. So in Numbers 21, 6 to 8, where you have the seraphim that's put on the post to cure the Israelites, as opposed to the nakash, which are is the other term for serpents. This is a distinction for a fiery serpent or a fiery serpent angel. And in that case, I think it was with an angel. And we also get that in Deuteronomy 8:15, and in Isaiah 14:29, we get a classic case of a seraphim angel being described, again, linked to the fiery serpent angel, and it's a flying one. And again, I have a commentary on Isaiah 13 and 14, which will cover the serpent's root that it's talking about in Isaiah 14:29. And also in Isaiah 36, you get an interesting linkage where you have lions, vipers, which are serpents, and flying, fiery serpents, which are the seraphim angels. And this is, again, a worldwide legacy. So if we now expand that out of the Bible, and you look at the feathered serpents of the Kishimaya and the Aztecs with gods like Quetzalcoatl or Viracocha and all the gods through Central America, these are the plumed serpent or the feathered serpent. These are seraphim angels. And again, they produced offspring that were the kings, and they look just like them. You also have the Nagas in India, who created a warrior and a priest class. You also have Enki, who's a serpent angel who produces offspring as well. You have the Ogdoad gods of Egypt that produce Osiris, who's depicted as a serpent king demigod as well. And you also have the Chinese dragon gods who produce the dragon kings of China, and on and on and on. So this is not an unknown concept within polytheism. It's just a parallel version of what they're offering in terms of the events of prehistory and the history, as opposed to what the Bible is describing is the monotheist account as it's seen through the offspring of Adam and Noah and the Israelites. So this understanding that these were powerful warriors, just as Goliath was a powerful warrior and Og was a powerful warrior and a warrior king, this is a concept that transcends the serpent-like look of the most common variety, as I would call it, of Nephilim. So I'm going to throw some other possibilities that there were different looking Nephilim, different branches that also send a lot of their imagery down through the royal families as they show up in their flags, their coat of arms, and the iconology that surrounds various kingships around the world. And one of those are the lion type of warriors that I think were another type of Nephilim. And in the polytheist versions, all of these lion warriors, and these were great warriors that were used in their armies, they were the offspring of certain gods again. So again, they have this nobility class. They may not have been the rulers, they may have been the cousins, but they were part of this infrastructure of the serpentine, Rephaim, and Nephilim, and worked hand in hand as they made their various alliances. And an example of that might be the Urmahalulo and the Lamassu of Mesopotamia and Sumeria. And these were lion-faced warriors, and they were used aggressively in the battles for their different types of traits that they could bring, being typically four-legged and sometimes they were two-legged, but they brought different types of strength and speed and viciousness, and they had the face of a lion. And one then presumes they probably used their mouth as part of that warrior sort of aspect. And another type of lion men show up in Nubia as the Epedamak. And these, again, they had offspring, and they were warrior offspring. Just as in Egypt, as you move northwards, you have lion warriors on reliefs all over Egypt, and they tend to come from Mahi and Sekhmet and Bast, which were lion type of gods. And out of Mesopotamia, you have a lion god named Nergal, who seemingly is the parent to these Urmahalu and Lamassu. And Nergal shows up in 2 Kings 1730, which has some other interesting characters we're going to come back to in a few minutes. But again, we're seeing the same type of thing going on with the lion men and warriors as with the serpentine kings of the Nephilim and the Rephaim. And I think these are another type of Nephilim. And so with the Epedamak god of Nubia, he had a lion's head with a serpent's body, which is really interesting because it's kind of like a mix that produced these type of lion men warriors. And what's relevant to me on that is, as you move into how it affects Christianity and the rival religions that affected the West for Christianity, you have Mithraism and Gnosticism. And with Mithraism, which I think is combined by Constantine with Christianity when it's placed over the Roman Empire as the new state religion, you have Mithras, who also has a lion's head and a serpent's body, and Ialdabaoth, or Demiurge of the Gnostics, who also has a lion head and a serpent body. And of course, this is the angel that the Gnostics like to say is the evil god of the Bible, and they're trying to degrade God to an angel status and equal to that of Satan, which is definitely not the case. But where we can bring this back biblically is with the lion men of Gad. And that's in 1 Chronicles 12:8. And these were fleet of foot warriors, just like the original Nephilim and the Rephaim were very dexterous and fleet of foot. And again, a common description that's used for these type of warrior class around the world. And what's interesting with them is not only did they have faces like lions, they're also called wilderness men. And if you take wilderness men back to Hebrew, that's going to come up as gibberim, which are used to describe Nephilim in Genesis 6 and used throughout the Bible to describe various Rephaim after the flood. But also understanding gibberim can just mean strong, mighty. It can describe an angel, and it can also describe and is used to describe God's strength. So you have to look at the narrative for the application. But when I see lion men and gibberim together, I think the narrative and warrior, I think the narrative is suggesting that these are a type of Nephilim. And then we also get the lion men of Moab showing up in 2 Samuel 23:20 and 1 Chronicles 11:22. And again, these are, again, a warrior type of people that David's men are dealing with, just as David's men and David are dealing with eliminating the last of the Rephaim in the time of the monarchy so that King Solomon can come in and they can set up the temple and he can move into sort of the next part of Israel's destiny. So, you know, Goliath and Lami are both part of the giants that go back to Rapha, as it's described in those accounts in the Bible. And again, they were Rephaim just by using the etymology and taking it back to Hebrew. But what we're not necessarily told, again, in the Bible is who these beings were created by. But as we talked about, we have all these other polytheist gods in other pantheons around the world, and I think these are the fallen angels and the rebellious angels. And so, again, Nergal is one of those significant options. But another one is how you take lion back to Hebrew, which is the word Ari, A-R-I-Y, and you put an E-L on there, and you arrive at Ariel. Now, Ariel does not show up in the Bible, but again does in the occult religions as one of the more significant angels, and that means Lion of God, and it actually is a Hebrew word where you get that definition as the Lion of God, which would be like an angel's name ending in E-L and with a meaning. And so I think that may have been one of the rebellious angels, but we don't have scripture to substantiate that. We just have the parallel accounts that sort of ascribe ourselves to that as likely being the case with the same type of creation, the same type of beings, and of course, lion showing up in the coat of arms. So dragon, serpent, lion is very, very common in coat of arms, and that's taking their royal bloodlines back to the Rephaim, Nephilim, and fallen angels of the rebellion. Next possible kind is, you might be familiar with the Anunnaki, which are the raven type of angels in Sumeria. And I think there was another kind of Nephilim that were created by these raven type birds that gave them that kind of look. And so we get in Judges 7:25, these two kings of Midian who, again, the Israelites, with this is now the time of Moses and Joshua, are attacking all of these, and being attacked by all of these Rephaim-led nations and giant infested nations of hybrids of humans and Rephaim and of the original Rephaim, all with likely Rephaim kings and bloodlines. So in Judges 7:25 and Psalm 83:11, you get the name of one of these kings of Midia as Orap, and that goes back to Raven, and Raven as in the look of the Anunnaki. So anything that's got to do with ravenous or ravening in the King James Bible and other translations, that is going to be one of those marker words you need to understand, because it's closely related to other beasts with the same type of meanings, whether or not it's ravens or owls or dragons or wolves or owls. They're all part of that type of Nephilim violations against the laws of creation that show up as demon beings and offsprings of angels that these violations and beings took the looks of their procreators. And so we'll know some of this from around the world if we actually take a step back and look at, again, the parallel accounts in the polytheist religions around the world, as with the Thunderbird gods and demons in North America. They're describing the same group of gods and their offspring. And again, Thunderbirds are both gods and offspring, and demon spirits, as those offspring die, as with the Nephilim and the Rephaim, but their spirits don't go to sleep. So these are the same type of beings. And you also have the Tengu of India, you have the Tengu of China, Tengu of Japan, and of Southeast Asia that also has the same type of beings being gods, and also producing offspring, again, of a warrior class and a priest class, which is, again, very, very similar to what happened in Sumeria with the warrior class of these type of beings and also the priest class, like the Sabeti, the Shebtiu. These are all the same, the seven sages. These are all part of that Nephilim priest class. And it's, again, it's the same story that's told around the world. So we need to look at both branches of the warrior and the priest class and how that organizational structure I talked about that imposed that feudal system over humans and still remains to today in most parts of the world has affected our history. And we need to be aware of the history of that, where it came from, and how it has affected us. And we also have, just to take that across the ocean into the Kishimaya, you have the Xibalba of the Kishimaya, which again have these bird owl like look that were again these demigods and demon spirits of the underworld. So again, a close association, no matter where you go, of the same type of beings. And they also have in that tradition the Kamazot, which is their origination for the Batman, of this Kamazot being and or god and or race of beings, where I think the superhero Batman comes from, just as all superheroes seem to go back to some sort of Nephilim type of character, as we understand that in the superhero tradition today. There's also another kind that I want people aware of, and it's the dog warrior. And we don't get a lot of references in the Bible, but we get a lot of references from around the world again on this. And in Judges 7 to 8, where we had these two Median kings, where Oreb, which is Hebrew for raven, you have now the same type of Oreb that is, I think I've gotten the name mixed up on that, but it goes back to wolf. It just as Caleb, as a Kenizzite, goes back to dog as well. And again, these kings of Media, or even Caleb, and that may just be an allegory because he's a Kenizzite that joins up with the tribe of Judah at the time of the Exodus, to describe his warrior-like aspects, and he was a great warrior. But you have this connection back to dogs, again, all around the world. Just as in 2 Kings 17:31, you have Nebaz, which is Hebrew for Nabak, which means to bark. And this is a god that the Avim, which is a division of the Rephaim, worshipped, which is a very interesting connection that is just sort of astounding when you actually put those two things together. And what's interesting about the dog warriors is that historians around the world, ancient historians like Herodotus or Hesiod or Pliny or Cestius and more, documented these warrior beings. And they were famous, renowned warriors, just as the Nephilim were men of renown, and they were mighty ones. And again, we don't get a lot of references, but I think if you look at one significant one, it leads you in that sort of direction. So in Isaiah 14:12, you have Hallel, which is who I think is the original name for Satan, which is used as the word Lucifer in the King James Version Bible. But Hallel, as you take that back, is also rooted in Hebrew, in the Hebrew word Yelal, which means howlings, which again comes up in Isaiah 14 and Isaiah 34 and in Isaiah 13. So I think howling, gods, Satan, underworld are all part of this connection to gods that created these Nephilim type of beings. And what's interesting about that is you have, again, Tiango gods in China creating the dog warriors. You have Anubis and Set in Egypt creating dog warriors. You have Baal in Sumeria that a lot of people think Baal Wow comes from. You have the Huayquotl gods, if I got that pronunciation close, I hope, from the Aztecs and the Quiche Maya, and there's a few other gods that also created these dog warriors and noble kings and princes who had their own lines. But it seems like the serpent ones were the superior ones, and particularly the dog warriors are sort of the lowest class of these Nephilim type of creatures. So I just wanted to open people's sort of eyes to looking at this Nephilim concept as a greater concept than just the giants, and that this notion of these violations against the laws of creation are going to be part of the end days. So understanding the players, understanding the prehistory, is going to enable you not to be deceived as to what's going to be taking place in the end time and where these beings come from, because you know it's part of the ancient rebellion and the consequences that have rolled thereafter, to ensure, at least by the fallen angels, what they're trying to do is ensure that the descendants of Adam, humans, are not going to be raised above angels in the future time, and that the rebellion was totally futile. They've been trying to prevent that all along. The resurrection of Jesus basically ended that, but they continue the fight because it's all they have left. And so this will continue right through to the end time. And all of this will be part of how we need to discern in the end time so that we're not going to be deceived, because they're going to use all of this to try and deceive us. So if anybody would like handouts in terms of what I've been talking about today, I have a three-part series on the Dog Warriors. I have a Lion Men document I can send you. And I have a second incursion document that we talked about. And again, I have a document that shows you why the angels are the sons of God. So for all of that I've mentioned today, I've got handouts for. Just get a hold of me through my website, thegenesis6conspiracy.com. That's the number 6. And I will get those documents back to you. And I, for signing off today and seeing you in a couple of weeks, where we'll have another interesting subject. We're going to approach it from a contrarian perspective, where we try and verify things through the Bible and other things around that we know, but measuring everything against what the Bible says. Thank you, and see you next time.